When I started studying neuroscience, they told us the brain didn't change after age 7.
Shamini Jain.
Expert in biofield research. She's a PhD. She's a psychologist, scientist, a social entrepreneur. She's the founder and CEO of the Conscious and Healing Initiative, CHI.
So there was a skeptical part of me that was like, is this real? Is consciousness as powerful as they're saying? Growing up as an East Indian in the Jan tradition in the Deep South here in the United States, I was the only Indian back then in this town of Greenville, South Carolina. And they would ask questions about Jainism, Hinduism, why do you guys worship cows? India, we regard as the motherland. And it's not just Indians that feel that way. Each of us have our own unique gifts. We know we have our prakriti. We're all, you know, a specific composition of consciousness in different ways. Some of us have more fire. Some of us have more water. So we can honor our gifts, but recognize that we're a part of co-creation.
You have got Deepak Chopra on the other hand, you have got Bruce Lipton. Do they experience jealous of each other?
Bruce, you know, he's 80 years old now. He wakes up in the morning and he says, I'm alive. I'm alive. I'm here on the planet for another day. And then he says, what fun thing do I want to do today? And I just love that and I resonate. We all have the human wounds, and typically those relate to self-worth in some way. I'm unlovable, I'm helpless, I'm incompetent. If you can just recognize when that pops up again with curiosity and be like, oh, that's so interesting.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the podcast, The Ex-Monk's Drive. This is your host, Gaurav, and today we have an extraordinary guest alongside us. She's not just a neuroscience expert, but also a TEDx speaker, an accomplished author, and above all, a conscious being. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Shamini Jain. Today, we will delve into her remarkable journey, exploring how her insatiable curiosity and unwavering passion have shaped her into the inspiring individual she is today. So buckle up as we dive in on this enlightening journey together. Hey Shamini, thank you so much for accepting my invitation and be my guest on the podcast, The Ex-Monk's Drive.
Gaurav, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me with you.
Shukran, thank you. And Shamini, I must tell you that while doing all my research and the homework, the more I was trying to know about you, the more I was getting nervous because of the accomplishments, the kind of work that you have done. And as I was telling you, very inspiring, very, very inspiring. And every time when somebody has a profile like yours, it does not only inspires me, it gives me hope that this is possible.
Oh, thank you. That's very, very kind.
Shukran. Shamini, you're an expert on neuroscience, you're an expert on consciousness. You share stage with the likes of Bruce Lipton's and the Deepak Chopras of the world. You're an author. You have spoken on TEDx platform. And I can go on and on and on. How did this journey of yours begin?
Gaurav, it's a wonderful question. I will share that for me, and I believe many of my colleagues, it starts with two things, really. A deep passion and a deep curiosity. And that's really what has started me on my journey. As I shared with you, everything that has happened for me personally has been literally through following my heart. And of course, the head is important to talk with the heart. You want that heart-brain communication always. So the curiosity initially started off in my heart, but also very much in my brain, you know, wanting to understand and make sense of things in life, especially growing up as an East Indian in the Jan tradition in the Deep South here in the United States, surrounded by my Baptist Christian friends who were deeply religious and spiritual in their own right. And they would ask questions about Jainism and, of course, confuse it with Hinduism and why do you guys worship cows and the whole bit, right? So right away, we were kind of discussing our religious and spiritual faiths and learning from each other. And they were really deeply curious themselves. But one thing I found very quickly growing up here in the U.S. is that because of the necessary separation of church and state, when I would read my books in Jainism, which were typically written by monks, on extraordinary states of consciousness, the power of yoga, on the autonomic nervous system. I mean, these books were so detailed. If you do this kind of pranayama practice, you're going to change your nervous system in this way. And even then, as a skeptical scientist, my father's a chemist, even though we were deeply spiritual, I would kind of cross my arms and be like, how do they know that? How do I know that's really true, right? So there was a skeptical part of me that was like, is this real? Is consciousness as powerful as they're saying? And if so, what does that mean for healing and humanity? So when I found myself studying neuroscience first at Columbia University, I want to tell you this. In the early 90s, when I started studying neuroscience, they told us the brain didn't change after age 7.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, clearly now we know that's not true. Neuroplasticity is a thing, and it happens even in late adult life and can happen with many different kinds of experiences, including meditation. But imagine coming from Indian heritage and learning everything that we've learned in our shastras, in our backgrounds, in our practice, and then you hear something like, the brain is static, it doesn't change until age 7, you know, it's sort of gloom and doom, whatever, you know, background you were raised with, environment you were raised in, sets your genes in a certain way, and there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that's literally what they were saying in the early 90s. Only 40, 50 years ago, we didn't even believe our brain connected with our immune system.
Yeah.
I think, Gaurav, that having the background in my Indian heritage really helped me to question even that. So on one hand, I was questioning what was in our shastras. But on the other hand, I was just as skeptical about what we were saying we knew in science. Because as a scientist, you know that knowledge is always evolving, whether it's spiritual knowledge and your own spiritual knowledge or the science. And we ask better questions as we get deeply more refined into a process, and including our own process. So it's beautiful because all of this has really led me to, of course, the speaking, the teaching, the writing, and all of that. But it's really been also now, I think, a love of sharing what I've learned. Because those of us who love to learn, we like to dig in, and then we like to talk about it. We like to share what we're learning so that others can benefit. And I feel like I've been really, really privileged to be at great universities and learn so much and do my own research and my own teaching and practice. So now it's like, it's time for us to put all of this together. And I think those of us coming from different cultures, we have so much that we can share with the global community here. And of course, India, we regard as the motherland. And it's not just Indians that feel that way, by the way.
Yes. Shamini, you spoke about neuroscience. You spoke about neuroplasticity. And that's one of the subjects I would like to dig deeper into. Before we get there, you also spoke about curiosity. Very often people talk about that I followed my passion. Not many people speak about curiosity. Tell me the role curiosity has played in your life.
Curiosity is such a beautiful experience, not just for scientists and artists, but for all of us. First, curiosity immediately suspends judgment. And you'll hear teachers, meditation, and mindfulness talk about this, right? Because even when an emotion comes up, rather than freak out about it, which we've usually been taught to do, especially if it's negative emotion or even desire sometimes in our culture, you know, we're taught to shut everything down. Instead, we can be deeply curious. So that allows for a level of what we often call in our communities, Indian communities, detachment, right? Non-judgment. So it's a very useful thing to be deeply curious about everything, including your own experience and your emotional reactions. I found that to be true as a clinical psychologist and even for myself personally. But also the curiosity about how things work in the world. A curiosity brings you essentially out of your conditioned mind into the invitation for a broader awareness. And when that happens, you know, you can make key scientific advancements. You can have a broader reach for innovative thinking because you're literally, you know, from an energy point, and you know that I study the biofield, and we can talk about that if you want. You're literally opening the field when you go into a curious state. And from a neuroscience perspective, this is really important too, because one of the things that curiosity can do, if we're really deeply curious and we're observing, we can enter states of awe. And when we enter states of awe, we can suspend the ruminative thinking about I, me, mine, the kind of mental rut that we can get into ourselves, whether we're trying to solve a problem or we're regurgitating an emotion over and over, we kind of get stuck in our own loop, right? So curiosity can help take you out of that loop. And that's why I think it's just such a useful tool. It's a way of being, really, that can really open you up to things in your life.
Yeah. And I could so much resonate with you, especially when you said it allows you to suspend your judgments and allows you to get out of that cycle, the vicious cycle that you have gotten yourself into.
Yes.
And you also use the word detachment in between.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was like, wow, everything is coming together. Everything is falling in place. And I didn't know that it all begins. The seed is curiosity. Shamini, help me understand. From where you look at your life today, being so accomplished, I don't know if being accomplished is the right word.
I don't either.
Yeah. Because I think the word accomplishment comes from a space of comparison. Would love to see the world through the eyes of 5-year-old Shamini. What was the worldview for you when you were really young? I'm sure at that point in time, as much as you might not like it today, all of us get stuck with some kind of comparison, some kind of ego, where you say that, know what, my frock is better than yours. I have a pink color doll, which is much beautiful than yours. My dad works here, and your dad does not have that car that my dad has. Are you able to relate to what I'm talking about?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I really appreciate the question. It's a beautiful question. And honestly, all the podcasts that I've done, I don't think anyone straight out asked me like that. What was your childhood like anyway? What kind of wounding did you experience that kind of shifted the way that you thought about things and your worldview even today? And I really appreciate the question, Gaurav, so thank you. And I'm tapping back into five in particular. A few things were going on for me then. One, I was singing to myself around the house constantly because it was a way that I self-soothed when things were rough. And I just remember at a very young age realizing that I could sing to myself, as singing is one of my deepest loves. I love to sing. I recently actually just released my debut album called Kali Yug Blues. And it's deeply rock. We can talk about that. I have a strong rock history. Anyway. I sang to self-soothe, and I started noticing the power of vibration right away for me, even at that young age. So that was one thing that was happening. The other thing that was happening was I was in first grade when I was five. I started kindergarten early. And again, as I mentioned, I was in the Deep South. And I noticed that I didn't have a lot of friends, but I had a lot of people who would come up to me when they wanted answers to the test. I don't know if anyone else can relate to this. So I was the only Indian back then in this town of Greenville, South Carolina, where I currently actually reside. There weren't a lot of Indians. My parents were actually the first Indians to come to Greenville about 60 some years ago. And I realized that I was probably othered, but I didn't know why. Now, I've had deep conversations with my husband, who is also Indian, who experienced overt racism when he was growing up. I didn't really feel like I experienced overt racism, but now looking back, I realized that the reason I was probably othered was because of the color of my skin. But honestly, back then, and even growing up, I just figured, oh, there are a million reasons why people couldn't like me or don't relate to me, so it doesn't really matter. So in a way, that really did shape me just saying, well, I'm just going to do what I want to do because I'm not going to fit in anywhere anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But I think the seeds of that actually came when I was five and I realized, oh, okay, well, people will reach out to me when they need something from me, but I don't necessarily feel really close to my classmates. Now that changed over time. I made good friends, you know, who were white mostly, and there weren't many people of color at all where I was growing up. So, but those initial formative times made me realize that in some way I was different, but I didn't have enough understanding or background. And certainly is nothing my parents ever talked about because their generation was all about assimilation, right? It's just like, be like everybody else. So that's kind of how they were running things, even though they had their deep Indian community. They also had the American community. But we didn't talk about racism. We didn't talk about being othered the way we do now in our community. My children are growing up very, very differently.
Yeah. Now I can relate to you much better. The other day I was talking to a friend of mine that how we all are born, we walk through this journey called life, and we do things probably not because we are called to do those things, but because we don't have anything else to do and we have to pass time, and we continue to do that. And how all of us are so much indulged in this illusion, and we feel as if I have done this. Mm-hmm. It's happening because of me. I am the creator of whatever is happening. And the more we do that, the more we start to identify ourselves with that. And we give birth to this concept of othering that you spoke about.
Yes.
And the more we do that, the more we start to manifest pain and suffering in our lives.
Yes, so true. So true. And it's different than considering yourself as a part of co-creation. So, and we are unique. Each of us have our own unique gifts. We know we have our prakriti. We're all, you know, a specific composition of consciousness in different ways. Some of us have more fire. Some of us have more water. Some of us can, you know, get a project done quickly because we have a lot of fire and air. Some of us can bring a room together because we carry more water and we're more cohesive. So we can honor our gifts, but recognize that we're a part of co-creation. And that has really guided my journey. That's why we created the Consciousness and Healing Initiative, which is my nonprofit. Yeah. It's really a collaborative. And that's where we bring together all these co-creators to manifest things that can bring lightness, bring healing to others. We bring together wisdom perspectives from practitioners, healing practitioners, as well as contemplative teachers and scientists and educators and artists, because everyone, because of their life experience and their prakriti, their composition, they have something unique and beautiful to weave into the tapestry of our collective wholeness. And so tapping into that co-creative force is so much more fun than shouldering the responsibility of feeling like it's all on you. You know, a lot of us who are working in a leadership capacity often feel like that. It's like, oh, I've got to lead the team. I've got to, you know, move things forward. I've got to motivate everyone. But what I've noticed is if I regard each person on my team as part of the co-creative process, then they're more inspired to take agency and move things forward because they recognize they're part of the collective whole. I don't have to push them to do things.
Shamini, from here, you spoke about this not-for-profit initiative that you run, Healing and Consciousness Initiative. Would love to understand what goes in the mind of the people who are so-called healers, who are so-called co-creators of consciousness energy. And I'll tell you the context where I'm coming from. I do a lot of work with CXOs, CXOs minus one. I do a lot of work in the space of leadership development with different organizations. And I find, irrespective of the stage these people are at, irrespective of the designation these people are enjoying, and irrespective of the car that they drive, the brand that they wear, and the deep pockets that they have this streak of competition. They have this streak of othering. They have this streak of experiencing jealousy. And I understand these are normal emotions. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced these traits, these emotions, with people who are doing work in the space of consciousness?
Of course.
You
know,
when you have,
everyone is human.
You know, on one hand, you have got Deepak Chopra. On the other hand, you have got Bruce Lipton. Do they experience jealous of each other?
Well, the leaders, I'll be honest, the leaders that I've encountered, including the ones you've mentioned, Bruce, Deepak, and everyone, I have not experienced that with them. I have not experienced that. Maybe they have it. I haven't experienced it at all. What I experience, and I'll talk about Bruce in particular because I've been co-teaching with him most recently, you know, quite regularly. So we've been in each other's orbits now for a while. And I have to tell you on all levels how much deep respect I have for Bruce in so many ways. And going back to what you've said about, you know, what do we do with our time? And, you know, how do we even regard what we do with our time? Bruce has been telling me lately, you know, he's 80 years old now. He wakes up in the morning and he says, I'm alive. I'm alive. I'm here on the planet for another day. And then he says, what fun thing do I want to do today? And I just love that. And I resonate. I think that's why we love to teach together, because that's kind of how we view life. You know, it's kind of like, what can I co-create today? what fun can I have that might be meaningful to myself and others? And so I see that, again, when you move with curiosity, passion, and a love for what you're doing, there's no room for jealousy and competition, because you're not doing it for someone else, and you're not doing it out of a sense of a lack of self-worth. You know, not that all of us don't have the self-worth things that come back, because we all have the human wounds, and typically those relate to self-worth in some way. I'm unlovable, I'm helpless, I'm incompetent. I mean, we all have the core beliefs, right? We can get it all into that. You know, Gaurav, I'm sure you and your listeners are very familiar with it. We don't have to belabor it. But honestly, if you can just recognize when that pops up again with curiosity and be like, oh, that's so interesting. Let's dive in if we want, go in there. What triggered me? Why am I all of a sudden feeling competitive as opposed to creative? Then it's a different thing. So we can consciously shift that to, what do I want to create today? What needs to be created? What's in me? And honestly, for me, that's a daily process, sometimes an hourly process, because I wear a lot of different hats. I run the Consciousness and Healing Initiative. We run research projects. We're doing a documentary on healing right now. I fundraise a lot for my work as well. I interact with amazing people, both my board members and, you know, companions, our Healing Practitioner Council, Scientific Advisory Council. So there's a lot going on there. And then there's my speaking and teaching and writing work, my creative work, and like everyone, my family life. Sometimes it can feel really overwhelming. And if we start buying into the competitive, what I will call the wounded masculine model, that's the viewed through the lens of separation, me versus them, you know, competition versus collaboration. It's very, very narrow, one-sided, and drains your energy.
It does. And why would you call competitiveness as a wounded masculine energy?
It is because, and let me be very clear, because I get into trouble sometimes, especially with my dear colleagues in gender studies and everything changing in terms of gender identity.
Don't worry, I will take care of that. I will take the blunt.
That's a very, very beautiful.
Be as blunt as possible.
So masculine, feminine do not just apply to male and female. Masculine in this case is a beautiful set of attributes that we see in Chinese medicine, even Ayurveda and others, yin yang. We have different ways of talking about this, right? It's sort of like, let's drill down into details. And so when we do that, we kind of separate things out, right? This is largely how the scientific method even has been working for so many years. Drill down, we drill down, we drill down, and we name things and we categorize things and we use the mind to do all those things. So when we do that, we begin to separate. Okay, so now I'm here, I'm Chamonix, I have a nonprofit consciousness and healing initiative. But wait, there are these other organizations like the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology. They're all doing great work, similar and related to what I do. Do I want to view them as competition? If I do, what happens? I don't get to create with them, right? All of a sudden, I'm in my separation state of what I would call the wounded masculine. It becomes wounded when that lens of separation is connected with an emotion of fear. So fear drives wounding. You have fear that can drive the masculine tendency, and you have fear that can drive the feminine tendency.
Okay.
So fear in the wounded masculine can mean it's the arousal of my sympathetic nervous system. It's me now viewing this other as competition.
Just to put it in a complete space for myself, for the audience as well, that a female can also have wounded masculine energy, and that will show up the way she would compete with others, right? So
most
let's call it.
It's not related to gender. It's related to tendencies. And so wounded men can have wounded feminine, which looks like, I've been victimized. I am downtrodden. And some of these have to do with culture. So there is the cultural aspects of, you know, how women have been treated, not been given equal rights and not been given equal pay and all those things. But men can carry the wounded feminine aspects too of victimization, and women can carry wounded masculine aspects of aggression, right? So these are just two sides of the same coin. So
the way
what
in
is
India
the way
we
out?
Call it Shiv Shakti. Is the completeness
and the divine,
the wholeness,
masculine and feminine. Yes, the wholeness.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do we move from the wounded to the wholeness? It's very simple. It's to recognize the divine interplay of all of us as beautiful representations of consciousness and energy, of Shiv Shakti. So now I can look at another organization or another person and say, wow, what a cool thing they're doing. What a beautiful expression. What a beautiful study. What beautiful work they're forwarding out in the world. Oh, I wonder if there's some synergy between what we're doing and them. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But if there is, we should play together. That would be so fun. Maybe we can create something together. So now you bring the masculine and feminine together to create a wholeness. And from that wholeness comes emergence, right? So now something new arises, something beautiful and creative that you may not have thought about on your own. Yeah. Your competition versus creativity are very neurally different.
Yeah. Shamini, you have given a TED talk on interconnection and you're just talking about interconnection. Tell me more about that. Why do you believe that we are interconnected? In what space? On which orbit are you talking about? And what is the impact it has on humanity? And even better, what is the impact it has on my day-to-day life? Why do I need to care?
Yeah, that's really huge. Well, one, the most important thing is because when we recognize the truth of our interconnectedness, we realize we're no longer alone. We don't have to go it alone. And even energetically and spiritually, we can call for support in our darkest times. That's really the point, okay? That's what jazzes me about the work that we do in this area of the biofield, the fields of energy and information that guide our health. And so in my exploration of the science of this, we can look at the emotional level of connection, the neural level of connection, but also the energetic level of connection. And as you know, I talk about that in that most recent TEDx talk in TEDx Berkeley, that when we see healing practitioners, we can see that even our energy beyond physical perturbations, within even moving an acupuncture needle or breathing or stretching, our very consciousness and allowing for a greater consciousness to flow through us with the intention of holding space for someone's healing process can be profound. It can decrease anxiety. It can decrease pain. It can move the biology. And these are cell studies and animal studies, Gaurav, which, as you know, I talk about in my TEDx talk and also in my book, Healing Ourselves, which is very heavily referenced for the science nerds out there. Healing Ourselves, Biofield Science and the Future of Health is a book that I wrote with Sounds True at their request, actually. It has over 600 peer-reviewed published scientific references.
Wow.
Speaking to the power of connection. On the energetic, spiritual, but also the physical levels, we cover placebo, what we in the West here call mind-body-spirit practices like yoga, meditation, tai chi, and whatever. So, but what is the point? It's to realize that we always have help, first of all. And sometimes when we get into those kind of more narrow, oh my God, I'm stuck in my conditioned mind, you know, and like I can't get out, right? Just like my wounding and my trauma is like triggering me and all of that. Opening up to a broader connection is as easy as taking a breath, speaking with someone, or even going outside in nature and being with the other living beings around us. You know, as a Jan, I contemplate this a lot, right? We believe in ahimsa, nonviolence. Why? Because everything is conscious. Everything is conscious. Everything has a right to live. So when you're stuck in yourself, just go out and hang out with some of the other living Shakti around you, whether it's a blade of grass or a plant in your apartment or a friend or an animal, you know, whoever you can tolerate being around at that moment and kind of feel into them and come out of yourself a little bit. Because that connection is what, it's just our essence. We get trapped in this idea that we are our conditioned minds and egos and nothing more than that.
I think we are trapped because we feel safe. Otherwise, we are not clinging onto anything and we don't have any, at least to our mind, to our egoic mind, there's nothing that we can identify ourselves with. And that's the reason why we are clinging onto all that. Shamini, since we are talking about the concept of interconnection, it's a universal concept that we are talking about. It's a principle as per the biofield, as per the quantum physics. If you look at the context of the corporates, if you look at the context of organizations, I've experienced there are people that you're very comfortable with. There are people that you're not comfortable with. The moment these two people come together, there's a spark. They cannot stand each other. On the contrary, there are instances when these two people come together. They are so comfortable with each other. There's no clash. There's no spark. There is lightness. There is ease in the room. The environment becomes safer. What is that then? If we all are interconnected.
Well, we are all interconnected, but we carry around different personalities and different energies. And you can just look at this on a vibrational level. Of course, if we're all in our egos, then we're going to appraise the other person as competition. We're going to judge them. So all that mental, emotional stuff is there. But even on the vibrational level, when people come into a room and they're excited to work together, but they just notice they have resonance with certain people and not others, that's vibrational. It actually has to do with the qualities of energy that we carry. Like sometimes fire and fire don't go together. You get strong personalities in the room, and sure, there can be ego related to that because they want it their way. But also, it's just an energetic thing. You think of two magnets and how they can repel each other or attract, right? So what do you do in that situation, and how do you create harmony? Actually, you can use Ayurvedic principles to do all of this. But I find that number one is to align on the common shared value. Pretty basic, right?
Yeah.
Up level a little bit. So now it's like we're not just working on the project, but like, what are we wanting to accomplish with this? What is the impact that we want to have in the world or for the company or for our bottom line or whatever it is, right? Like, really make sure you've got alignment on that shared value, because now you're moving their energies to the value, and the value is informing what happens next.
Values unite always.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then respect that the ways to achieve that value may be different. And as a team leader, if you're in a situation where you're leading teams with varied personalities and energies, and some of them get along, some of them don't, you know, it's a dance. You're the conductor, but it's about making sure that you're also honoring and respecting and letting them know that you honor and respect each of their ways. So nobody feels like they're not being seen or heard.
Yeah. I'm sure it's easier said than done, because when the sparks happen, we try and protect ourselves.
Yeah. So the more that we lead, the more we have to deepen our practice and particularly the practice of presence.
Yeah.
Because if we react, and one of my healing teachers likes to say, the biggest aura wins. Okay. So typically as a leader, you're meant to carry the biggest aura. So your aura has to be one of inclusivity and groundedness. Because if you come in reactive, forget it.
You know, and when you're using the word inclusivity and groundedness, and you use the word presence, every time when there is awareness, there's presence, there's inclusivity, and there's groundedness, ego cannot stand there.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, what are the symptoms of ego? How does that manifest in an individual's life?
It's a contraction.
It's in the body.
It's a contraction. You can feel it. You can feel it in your energy, in your mind, in your emotions, and in your body. Your muscles literally tense. Your brain waves, you know, shift into more of a beta state, which is a tightness of the brain. If you look at the beta waves, and I'm sure you're familiar, alpha is a nice slow roll, theta is an even broader slow roll, right? And what happens with beta? You get tight, you contract. That's how you know ego is running the show.
Yeah. And would that person have the necessary awareness to identify that this is ego and I need to get out of that? Because I don't think there's a beautiful saying that when somebody's a fool, the world can get to know that, the fool will never get to know that. Same is the case with the ego.
Bringing your breath in your body is a great tool here. Because if we are practicing presence, and, you know, I teach ways to energetically ground and work with breath and sound to make sure that we're fully in our bodies, because I joke and call myself sometimes a recovering academic. There's that joke, you know, in I think, is it The Great Gatsby? You know, Mr. Duffy lived a little bit away from his body. So a lot of us have been taught to sort of live in the mental realm where we're not fully embodied in our energy and our breath. But if we are, then we'll notice right away when there's a contraction, because it will notice, oh, my breath just changed.
My muscles
got tighter, right? And so many of our meditation practices in Vipassana and others teach us how to be fully present in the body, moment to moment. And then we understand more quickly what's going on in ourselves and in the room.
And the more I'm listening to, the more I'm realizing that how in the corporate world that I work in, how the trait of being an ease to work with is underrated and how it's so important. Because if in my presence that the person is feeling contraction, as you mentioned, and there's a exponential spike of the beta waves in the environment that I'm a part of, what kind of psychological environment am I creating for the other team members? If I'm not even aware of that, I'm just wondering and concerned the kind of torture those people might be going through without me even realizing. And that's where I need to ground myself. I need to come back home. I need to be present and see what shifts can I bring in.
So this is the earth element. A lot of what we've been talking about is what I would, I think, and I like to distill things down into vibrational elements, because then there's less judgment about emotions and behaviors and things like that, right? And it's actually more of the essence of the thing, actually, to tap into the Shakti of it. So when you tap into the Shakti of leadership in today's world, there's already, as you know, with the information age, there's a lot of air, there's a lot of space, there's a lot of fire, there's a lot of movement happening all the time, things evolving, AI, this, that. It can dizzy the mind. It can actually even cause anxiety. So if you think about that from an embodied Shakti perspective, grounding and flowing are really important attributes for all of us now. So the earth element of grounding into, you know, presence is important. Really holding and anchoring the space, but also allowing for flow. And as you know, water and flow is the seat of creativity. It is the body of Saraswati Ma herself. She is the embodiment of wisdom and creativity. And this is what we all thirst for, literally. We thirst for the water. So we have all this wonderful air and ideas and the mentalizations moving, you know, at lightning speed. So Kali Ma is very much present these days. And many others, you know, but what about earth? What about water? So it can be a fun process, right? Just, oh God, I've got to ground. You don't have to be like, oh God, I've got to be the anchor, right? But you can be like, okay, how do we flow with this? How can we bring some joy and flow and creativity into the project?
I think, you know, the moment I'm saying that I need to get there, it has an underpinning in the urge that itself is counterintuitive to inviting flow and inviting awareness in your life.
You got it. Invite it. Beautiful.
So let's shift gears, Shamini, and would love to understand everything that you've been talking about in the context of leadership, where you work with top C-suite executives. What do you think? Why is it becoming more and more important for today's leader to understand the concept of neuroscience, terms like neuroplasticity? That's one on one hand. Why is it important for these people to understand the importance of consciousness to show up as a human being? Forget about leader. And the third thing that you spoke about, healing. So you choose where would you want to begin, and then we can tap into the other concepts.
Let's go back to what you had spoken about earlier about hope. The reason to be aware of what neuroscience is telling us isn't because you have to be up on all of the details of the latest data. The take-home message here is that we are constantly evolving, and so our brains are also constantly evolving as well. And so back to being a student in the early 90s, being told our brains don't change until after age 7, now to learn that our brains can actually shift
constantly
in terms of
cortical changing.
Yes, and the way that we optimize certain aspects of our brain function to have better memory, better regulation of emotion, you know, better retention, better information processing at any age. And practices like meditation can help us get there. Of course, nutrition, exercise. You know, there's a lot of excitement here in the West about psychedelics and the buzz about psychedelics and neuroplasticity.
Yes.
I want to remind people, though, that yes, that's super exciting and very, very cool. Again, you don't have to take psychedelics to change your brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can experience a really profound change for sure. But you can also get there using the tried and true spiritual practices that are involved in every tradition, including the psychedelic tradition.
Those
psychedelics were never meant to be used in our ancient indigenous traditions all over the world. They're part of ceremony. They're part of spirituality. They're not really meant to be taking a drug to sort of optimize brain function. And I just want to be really clear on that. The take home here is that when we change our state of being, our state of behavior, even our state of how we lead, we are shifting the way that our default mode network operates. Just very quickly, for those who aren't familiar with the default mode network, it's a network of brain regions that's often related to when I'm thinking about I, me, mine. Okay, so again, that conditioned sort of contracted mind. What I'm proposing, and I think you would agree, Gaurav, is that when we're in that conditioned contracted mind all the time, we limit our opportunities for creative, out-of-the-box thinking and innovations, which is so key to industry. So we don't want to always be running in the default mode network. If we use these tools that we've been talking about, coming into breath, shifting your energetic presence, many other tools, which I know I'm sure you teach also, we shift our brain. Not only that, but now here's where things get really interesting. And this is some of the work that we've done at the Consciousness and Healing Initiative. When we went to India pre-COVID with a delegation of scientists and healthcare practitioners, we went to several ashrams to study medicine in the traditional setting, in the ashram. So, of course, first we had to build trust and communication and collaboration with these Western scientists and our spiritual practitioners. But one of the things that we discovered that we want to follow up on in more studies is that when people meditated together, and particularly when they focused on the interior experience. So this was collaborations with our dear friends in Auroville and the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in Pondicherry. We found that people's brain waves actually cohered together. So we saw evidence for EEG coherence between brains when people were engaged in collective practice. This is, in the neuroscience tradition, this is becoming a very rich field of what we call hyperscanning studies. So if you even Google hyperscanning studies, you will see that when people do things together, their neurons literally fire together. So leadership is about literally creating coherence. And the cool thing is, you don't even have to meditate together. When you're really engaged in a focused project together, you're literally creating a coherent field. And there are studies now showing on the neuroscience level that when you create that coherent field, you create more cooperation and greater productivity. And that's really, really exciting.
So I understand it's becoming more and more important for people to understand neuroscience, because that has a direct impact on your awareness and how, when you work together, the neurons start to fire together. Is my understanding right?
That's right.
Yeah. So what are the different techniques and the tools grounded in neuroscience that corporate leaders, managers can use to change and adapt more effectively in the dynamic business environment that they are a part of?
So actually, the data suggests that when people sing and dance together, It can really cohere brainwaves. And this is intuitive too. Think about when you go to a concert and you can feel when everyone's in sync. You know, again, the performer is the primary resonator. Everyone's locking into the band or the singer or the guitarist or whatever. And, but you're all synced, right? So you can actually achieve this in the boardroom if you're brave enough to do things like sing a song together, create a song together, dance together, do fun things together that kind of lighten the mind. All of these things have actually been shown scientifically to show coherence in brainwave and even heart wave activity. So I encourage folks to think out of the box. Yes, meditation together, obviously, breathing together. You've got 5 minutes, you know, you don't have time to get up and dance together, which 5 minutes is plenty of time to dance together, I think. But they're a little nervous about doing that. Do some collective breathing exercises together. That's really great. Even of just a very brief Tai Chi or yoga pranayama exercise together will help to build the coherent field and the coherent brainwaves. And then start your meeting.
On one hand, when you introduce the concepts of neuroscience, I'm sure people will look up at you. Right? She's going to talk about neuroscience. She's a scientist. She has written a book. And when you speak about the concepts like mindfulness, meditation, let's dance together. Let's breathe together. Let's do japa together. How do people look at these softer and yet powerful techniques? I call them the techniques of a warrior monk. So when you introduce these concepts to the corporate leaders and the in the business environment, what is their first impression and how do you deal with that?
Honestly, it's very welcomed because, and you can see this even, you know, with the leadership at Google, for example. The top companies are doing everything they can to first reduce stress, provide enjoyment so that they can retain their employees and have productivity. And they want to get out of the box. Everyone wants to get out of the box. You just have to give permission for people to get out of the box. And the best way to do that is just to lead out of the box. You have to meet the corporate culture where it is. Sometimes getting everyone to dance together, you think, oh God, am I really going to get everyone to dance together? You'd be surprised. People are so happy to wiggle out of their seats and just sort of shake around a little bit. This is, again, a deeper conversation about bringing the feminine back into what we do.
I'm sure we can talk for hours and hours together. Shamini, what are you curious about? What are you working towards that we should be knowing?
I'm deeply curious about what we can all do to recognize that violence is not a solution to the issues that we have at hand. When I look at the global perspective and feel the deep suffering of what is happening with all the wars in the world and the polarities, it troubles me deeply. And so a lot of the work that I'm interested in forwarding these days is how do we apply the science, the beautiful deep science that we have on the power of connection and collective consciousness to solve some of these global problems that are instantiated in violence. So thank you for asking.
Thank you, Shamini, because the very fact that you spoke about, you could speak about anything. You could speak about all the things that you're an expert on. And yet you chose to speak about connection. And I personally believe that connection is one of the basic desires of a human soul. Human beings are wired for connection, and under threat, they get rewired for protection. So thank you for this beautiful message. And I look forward to having you again sometime on the podcast. And I'm sure we would have, as you mentioned, we'll have more moments to breathe together, dance together, sing together. By the way, would you like to sing just one sentence for our audience, if you may?
You know, if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind closing with a mantra, maybe. Would that
Let's
be okay?
Go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Saraswati Ma is kind of my home goddess. She's my homie. So we will close with a simple mantra for her. Saraswati Namastabhyam Varade Kamarupani Vidya Sarvam Karishami Siddhir Bhavatu Me Sadha Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Shubhra.
Thank you.
I'm so soothed right now. What a warm human being. One of the reasons I do this is to encounter such personalities and their auras. And trust me, it's blissful. With this, we wrap another episode on the podcast, The X-Monks Drive. It was lovely having you on the other side. See you next time, next week, with yet another interesting conversation. And yes, don't forget to follow our podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Do rate us and review us as well. And do share that with someone you believe would get benefited from this conversation. Signing out. Take care.